This is an ABC podcast.
Before we start today, we just want to advise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners that this episode of The Signal has some audio of people who have died. Last month, at least five First Nations people died in custody in Australia. Each of those deaths was an unspeakable tragedy. And what makes the situation worse is how common these horrors remain in Australia. 30 years ago today, a royal commission into Indigenous deaths in custody inspired some hope that something would change. So, has anything improved at all? I'm Stephen Smiley, and today on The Signal, we're hearing about the sometimes lethal reality of Australia's police and justice system for the nation's First Peoples. Could you introduce yourself for us?
My name is Isabella Higgins. I'm the ABC's Indigenous Affairs Correspondent. I'm also a Torres Strait Islander woman myself.
Great. Now, you have recently returned from a reporting trip out to Brewarrina. This is out in the northwest of New South Wales. Tell us a bit about the town of Brewarrina.
Yeah, well, it's a place with a pretty rich history. So you go there now, and I think only about 1,200 people live there, but there's all these grand old buildings, which I guess is a bit of a sign of the economic prosperity that gripped the area at the time. It was a prominent sort of sheep shearing community. So there's like this beautiful old hotel on the main street. The courthouse, weirdly, is one of the grandest buildings, but it's also a place with very prominent Indigenous significance. It was a place where a lot of Aboriginal tribes met, and a lot of people know it now because it is home to the fish traps, which is this 40,000-year-old structure. It's on state and national heritage registers and shows, I guess, the ingenuity of the Aboriginal people at the time to feed themselves, to live off the land.
Do you talk about the fish traps? I see the kids come down here fishing and swimming.
Where are my glasses?
Swimming and fishing. Can you see the pelicans over there, Nanny? Can you see it, apes? See the pelican? They look for fish. Yep.
And it's still a place that has a really big Aboriginal population, I think about 65%, because back in the day they kind of, well, it was missionaries and governments put people on missions to live Aboriginal people. And for a long time, really, until, you know, the better part of the late 20th century, that's where Aboriginal people lived.
He's hungry. And there's a fish jumping up and down there. It's jumping, yeah. It's getting away from the pelicans.
In recent times, you know, as recent as the 80s, it was a town that also found itself in the national spotlight for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and that's why specifically you went to Brewarrina on this recent trip of yours. One tragedy in particular, 33 years ago in 1987. Can you tell us about Lloyd Boney and what happened to him?
Yeah, so Lloyd Boney, he was part of a really big Aboriginal family from the area. And on a Thursday afternoon in 1987, he was arrested for a breach of bail. He was taken into the local police cell, and within 90 minutes, he was found dead.
16 Aborigines have been found dead in jail cells this year. And if this was South Africa, we might be the target of world condemnation. If the same proportion of the white population had been found dead in jail, there'd be outrage. But these are Aboriginal deaths. The latest Aborigine to die was Lloyd Boney. He was found hanging by a sock in his cell at Brewarrina on Friday. Max Utris went to Brewarrina during the weekend and found bewilderment and quiet anger amongst the town's Aborigines.
Obviously, this triggered an enormous grief for the family, but also an enormous grief for the larger Indigenous community. News crews were there straight away because this was just the latest in a spate of Indigenous deaths in custody. So when I was up there, I had a chat to Lloyd's brother, Glenn Boney, who remembers his brother with such fond memories, but also remembers the way the town kind of fell apart, the riots that happened in the town at the time.
And Glenn, can you take me back about 33 years ago? How old were you when the riots ripped through this town?
33 years ago, 21, I was. Yeah, I was 21 at the time.
And can you tell me, what are your memories of your brother passing?
Well, my memory was when the first day of my brother passed, that the police threw him in the police wagon and he was locked up again. That's just another thing that... Because he's been in prison that many times before, and we thought, oh, it's just another time that he's locked up in jail. But he was intoxicated that morning, and my brother see him get locked up, and then they see him go into the police station, and then probably an hour or so later, that's when we heard that he supposedly hung himself.
And how did it, did it hit the family pretty hard?
Big time, yeah, hit the family. It hurt the family big time because it brought us all together. We all came together and we all spoke about his life and how he'd been to prison so many times before, all over the state, and the hardest prisons in our state. And for him to do what he's supposedly done, that was the hardest part for us, the whole family, to accept that. And still today it's hard to accept what happened to him, what they supposedly said happened to him.
And there were obviously the riots that happened soon after. Why do you think that riot happened?
Why did I think the riot happened? A lot of anger in the community, amongst the family, friends.
So back in the 80s when Lloyd Burney died, as you said, in the cell at the Barorana police station, he was far from the first Indigenous person to die in circumstances like this. How widespread was this pattern?
Well, it had been making national headlines for the better part of a decade. So there was this Aboriginal committee that had formed at the time, and it had started counting the number of Indigenous deaths. And at that time, when Lloyd Burney died, they estimated there'd been about 44 deaths in custody in the last 10 years. So it was quite a lot. But with each death in custody, I guess it triggered more and more outrage. There were riots, there were rallies, Aboriginal families were really, really advocating for a royal commission because they wanted answers, they wanted justice for themselves. But by this point, it was very clear this was a systemic issue. There was systemic racism at play, and people, they wanted to save lives, but they wanted answers for themselves too.
But Lloyd's family, he was one of 21 children, is adamant he couldn't have taken his own life. His brothers say he was in high spirits on Thursday.
We were joking amongst the time. The boys gave him a nickname that day. It called him Chicken Barney. We laughed all day about it.
Never ever talked about it. Things like it.
That call for a royal commission, this is back in the late 80s, didn't fall on deaf ears. There was a royal commission. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it was just days after Lloyd Burney died. His death is very much considered the catalyst to the Hawke government calling the royal commission. So I think, as I said, he died on that Thursday afternoon, and by Monday, Bob Hawke got up and said, "We will listen to your calls. We will hold a royal commission. It needs to be a royal commission."
Although the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission was to conduct an inquiry into Aboriginals and the criminal justice system, the increasing calls from the Aboriginal community and from many others for a royal commission indicate to us, and we accept, that any inquiry which did not have the status of a royal commission would be unacceptable.
And what followed was 3 years of testimony. This royal commission travelled all around the country. They ended up investigating 99 deaths within the last 10 years throughout the 80s. And then eventually they handed down this enormous document, 339 recommendations. And I guess that's kind of the beginning of the story in many ways.
And what happened with those recommendations?
Well, the recommendations were really wide-ranging. You know, some of them were the obvious things around prison safety, justice diversion, post-death investigations, but a lot of them were actually really about social change. They were about investing in housing, investing in employment strategies, about healing the relationship between police and Aboriginal communities. And I mean, here we are 30 years on, there's only really been one review of how those recommendations were implemented, and that was a government issued review. It was done by Deloitte, and that found about 64% at best had been fully implemented. They estimated some others had maybe sort of been implemented here and there, but not substantially. That report is a little bit contentious because some experts in the space say, well, that was relying on states to, I guess, reflect on their own success. Mm-hmm. And what we do know is the main finding of the Royal Commission was that the best way to stop deaths in custody was actually to stop the disproportionate over-incarceration. And what's happened in 30 years is we've gone from having 14% of our prison population being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to it now being over 30%. So whether those recommendations were implemented or not, this is not a problem that's gone away.
And in fact, the proportion has doubled, as you just said. Now, the reason we're talking about this today specifically is today is the 30-year anniversary of the making of those recommendations, the wrapping up of that Royal Commission. And you have been speaking to people who have looked into this. Can you tell us what this anniversary means to people like that?
I guess it's a time to reflect on the national reckoning that was, and I guess the feeling of hope and change that people had. But I guess it's also a very sad anniversary to know that the fight of all of those families has more or less not amounted to change.
And one of those people Isabella spoke to was Meena Singh. She's a Yorta Yorta, an Indian woman, and is the legal director of the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne.
Sadly, things have changed for the worse. At the time that the Royal Commission happened, we were seeing, for the period of time that they were investigating, we were seeing 10 Aboriginal deaths in custody a year. And in the 30 years since the Royal Commission, we've seen over 450 Aboriginal deaths in custody, which means that over 15 families every year are losing someone to a death in custody. Very little has been done. Implementation of recommendations requires proper funding and support of Aboriginal community and organisations, as they have the solutions that they have had for far longer than 30 years. Supporting them, truly backing self-determination so they can lead the way in what we need to do to stop Aboriginal deaths in custody.
As you said, the patterns that people were protesting about back in the late 80s in Brewarrina, we're still seeing this happen today. In fact, in the month just gone, in March, we saw a number of deaths of Indigenous people in custody. Just what do we know about some of those cases?
Well, what we know is that they triggered really a collective outrage all over again, because it is happening in the climate that it is the 30th anniversary. We know that two of those deaths might never have come to public attention. They actually came out through a parliamentary inquiry in New South Wales.
So within the space of a week, there have been two First Nations deaths in custodies, one in Long Bay Prison Hospital and one in Silverwater Women's Prison, and you haven't told the public, Commissioner. That's the situation. Two deaths in 1 week and you decide not to tell the public.
Most tragically, and yes, I have not informed the public. I have informed all the oversight bodies, as we do and have done under our protocols.
And we know very little about the other three deaths as well, beyond, you know, very basic things like age, the place that they died. We don't even know the cause of death. And I guess it's a reflection that that Royal Commission that was really calling for transparency and accountability, that perhaps the country's leadership or haven't learned those lessons. And so when these things happen, when they feel a little bit secretive, you have the Aboriginal community who immediately assume, well, what are you hiding? And I'm not saying that, you know, authorities are hiding anything, but this is the way Aboriginal people feel when there is this lack of transparency, when things are kept behind closed doors. So we've seen rallies throughout the country over the last couple of weeks. So again, it is hitting a nerve and it is triggering that collective grief.
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want
justice?
When do we want it?
Now!
off the back of those rallies, as you said, there have been calls for at least a meeting of state and territory police ministers. This was something that we heard from Labor Senator Pat Dobson, who was himself one of the Royal Commissioners back in the late 80s and 90s. What exactly is Pat Dobson saying?
So we've got Pat Dobson calling on the federal government to hold a summit of sorts to get together state and territory police ministers, police bosses, to get them in a room and figure out how do we move forward. And what we actually did see last year, we did see some change in this country. We saw all state and territory governments agree to a national Indigenous justice target. So they all agreed that within a decade, they would move 15% of Indigenous adults and 30% of Indigenous young people out of prison. But so far, we're really yet to see any sort of substantial plan for how they're going to make that happen. So when Pat Dodson calls for a summit like this, you imagine that they're probably trying to figure out, well, what is the way forward for the next decade? How are we going to change these things? We've still got a bunch of recommendations that haven't been implemented from the Royal Commission. Just a few years ago, there was a very major report from the Australian Law Reform Commission that again laid out a bit of a pathway to change. The federal government's actually never even responded to that report. So it's just a bit of a call to action, really.
I think immediately each state and territory, their police officers, or the police ministers and the head of their police departments and the Attorney Generals in those jurisdictions, along with the Aboriginal Legal Services and other key organisations, the health services, should meet and focus in on why people are dying, what can be done to address that, particularly if there are health problems, and why it is that there isn't sufficient training being given to police once they leave the academy to deal with these issues.
And what has the federal government had to say in the lead up to today's anniversary on this whole question of whether or not things have got better?
There's certainly an acknowledgement from the federal government, particularly from the Minister for Indigenous Australians, that this is a very, very sad situation, that this is a situation that causes deep grief. But we see a lot that the federal government kind of defers this to state and territory, saying this is a state and territory responsibility. There's only so much we can do.
I guess the state and territories generally run these police stations, right? So these police departments.
Yeah, right. So there's an element of truth to that. I mean, they run policing, corrective services. They also run, you know, a lot of education, employment, those sort of services that Indigenous people need to access. So I guess it's a flaw in having a national agreement is that you're kind of relying on the will of each state and territory to make these changes. It's probably also worth noting that there have been some improvements in the last 30 years. The Australian Institute of Criminology points out that the death rate for Indigenous people who now enter custody, it's improved a bit. So prison safety, you could maybe say, is a bit better. Less Indigenous people die in custody than non-Indigenous people, but that doesn't mean the problem's fixed in any way. That's just like a proportion sort of thing. So Indigenous Australians still make up about 20% of deaths in custody, and they're 3% of the population. So while there have been some improvements to prison safety, again, the problem is far from fixed because of that disproportionate imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Take your knee off our necks!
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 Now, obviously, there has been also renewed attention on this issue in the past 12 months, sort of in the context of the global Black Lives Matter movement sparked by the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. What do young people in places like Brewarrina think about all of these issues that we're talking about, and are they optimistic that things might get better?
Yeah, so when I was there, I decided to, you know, tag along to the local footy training, meet some of the young guys out there, and I had a chat to the Brewarrina Golden Googers president, Chris McHughes, and he was pretty honest too. He's like, look, we know this stuff happens. We still deal with racial issues all the time. All of us know police brutality is a problem. All of us know what happens to our people in custody. We also can see that things are maybe a bit better for us than our parents, but we know the challenges ahead and we don't necessarily see that change coming.
Yeah, there's a fear. We, you know, a lot of, not only men, but women as well. what goes on in our justice systems.
And what was it like to grow up here, like a place like Bree, where it's had, you know, such big traumas and families who carry that kind of wound, those wounds and grief?
Yeah, so like there's, you know, there's traumas with everything. The drugs and alcohol trauma and you know, the trauma, you know, sexual assault traumas and the, you know, the fatalities traumas and all that. The generation today know what happens, you know, around Australia, not only around Australia but around the world, what's going on with, you know, cultural issues, with trauma also. You know, they could bring up things that they happened to them when they was young, and that creates, you know, more trauma and grief and when they, you know, start to get older.
You also spoke to the family of Lloyd Boney about this question, about their reflections 30 years on. What did they have to say?
Well, they didn't really mince their words. They were pretty open and honest in that for them they feel like not much has changed.
Do I think that the Royal Commission brings the change to the community? In honesty? No. I'd like to see more, not for just our community, for other little towns, for everyone in Australia. Yeah.
I guess what's your hope for the next generation?
I don't know. You know, I haven't thought that far, but I hope something really good comes, not for, like, for my grandkids, for Glenn's grandkids, for everyone's grandkids, for the next generation. I don't know. When is this racism going to stop? Really? I knew that stuff gonna stop.
Do you feel like the Royal Commission changed anything for the better for your family or your community or the country?
No. It hasn't changed nothing, really. All I feel, the policing's gotten worse since the Royal Commission. That includes the police force, because we still have that. We still have a lot of issues with the people in this town. We have a lot of police issues with the local police. And it's not only this community, and I know a lot of people in other communities that I travel in know, really, they go through the same stuff we're going through here. And the Royal Commission, they could have spent it, put it into the Aboriginal communities and done a lot of good things with it instead of spending it on the Royal Commission. Because all the lawyers made a lot of money out of it, and our people still dying in custody. Well, we had four last week or fortnight ago in 1 week. Shame on the country, it's a shame. And it opened our wounds up and we could feel for those families what they've been through.
That is the signal for today. Thank you very much for listening. If this episode has raised anything for you, there is always help. You could call Lifeline. The number is 13 11 14. And we'll be back with a new episode of The Signal early tomorrow morning. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.